Hi, everybody. Geraldo here. Welcome to Geraldo Rivera, the podcast. If this is your first time listening, thank you very much for tuning us in. Every week or so, I'll give you my thoughts, my opinions on the air, on the latest news. There's so much to talk about now in the age of Trump. You can have show notes if you need them. They can be found on my website, geraldo.com. Come back often. Feel free to add the podcast to your favorite RSS feed. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also follow me on Twitter at Geraldo Rivera and on Facebook, Geraldo Rivera. All these links are in the show notes. Again, thanks for tuning us in. Here now the show. Hi, everybody. I'm Geraldo Rivera, and this is Geraldo the Podcast. We are live on Facebook Live and to an internet outlet near you. This is the 10th edition of the podcast. It is the 10th of March. Crazy, crazy weather here in New York. The sun was out just a couple of minutes ago. What makes that interesting is that it had been snowing for the 10 hours before that. What makes it even more interesting is that just yesterday was springtime here in New York. It was 70 degrees. I was riding my bicycle everywhere. I ride my bicycle a lot in New York. The traffic, first of all, is horrendous in Manhattan. It's never been worse. You have all these Uber guys, the Uber guys and the Lyft guys, added to the usual, the gypsy cabs. They have green cabs. They have yellow cabs. They have all the livery guys. The streets of New York are absolutely choked with traffic. Plus, there's construction on every cross street. So it can literally take you an hour. It can take you an hour to go the 1 mile. Manhattan is 1 mile wide by 11 miles long. It can take you an hour to go the 1 mile across town. When I stay in our home in Edgewater, New Jersey, sometimes it takes me less time to get from Edgewater across the George Washington Bridge down the West Side Highway to 48th Street as it takes me to get from 48th Street on the West Side Highway just 5 or 6 blocks to Fox News. So it's really incredible how bad the traffic is. That is why I ride my bicycle everywhere. And typically, I have all kinds of stops during the day. Like yesterday, I came here first to Fox. This is my office at Fox News. Then I went to my accountant. Then I got my haircut. Had to come back to Fox for another program. And then went to Broadway. Before I tell you about Broadway, the day before yesterday was the women's strike. The day without women. So there were several thousand of them out in front of Trump Tower on 5th Avenue and 56th Street. Actually, they were all the way from about, I'd say, 59th Street down to 56th Street. Thousands and thousands of women. And I rode to work. I rode past everyone on my bicycle. So I'm waving and waving everybody. So people are saying hi. You know, everybody recognizes me, especially here in New York. So they know I work for Fox News. So it's either a kind reference or some anti-Fox reference. But it was so funny. It was almost like I was passing in review thousands and thousands of women. There I was on my bicycle. So the last stop, I drove from my bicycle from Fox, just the 3 blocks or so to Times Square, to the Hudson Theater, where Sunday in the Park with George, starring Jake Gyllenhaal, is playing. Jake Gyllenhaal is a great actor. In fact, he went to high school, Harvard Westlake, with my son, my oldest son, Gabriel, my 38-year-old son, who now lives in Amsterdam, Holland. They went to high school together. I thought that he was great. I thought Jake Gyllenhaal was great as George Seurat, the painter. You know, the whole thing is it's a story behind a very famous French impressionist painting that was done at the end of the 19th century. So it tells kind of the backstory or an imaginary story about that. Jake Gyllenhaal was great. It was just Saul and I, the 11-year-old, and Erica, my wife, her mom. So funny. Saul loves Broadway. And here she is, 11 years old. She's been to more shows probably than I have. I didn't even start going to Broadway till I was 21 years old. Saul is so sophisticated. But one of the most fun things, when you have a big star turn, like Jake Gyllenhaal appearing in a limited edition of this play, Sunday in the Park with George, you have all the different stars go by. And Erica, my wife, and Saul were so excited to see Andrew Reynolds. He's the guy from Girls. And if you're a Broadway buff, he also was the Elder Price in the Book of Mormon, which is absolutely one of the funniest comedies ever in the history of Broadway. But they were so excited to see Andrew Reynolds. You know, he was just had the shower scene in Girls, in the Girls finale that was just on. And then, so the girls are very excited about seeing Andrew Reynolds. But then on the way out, we saw this most stunning couple, like you could possibly imagine, tall, drop dead gorgeous. It was Blake Lively and her husband, Ryan Reynolds. You know, they're like 6'2". They look like Adonis and Venus. They came gliding in. They were actually headed backstage. We were going to go backstage. It was so late. It was a school night for Soul, so it was too late for us to go say hi to Jake. I wanted to, but Broadway is so glamorous. If you have a chance, patronize Broadway in your own town. But if you come here, it really is a thrill. You can't come to New York and not see a show. Speaking of shows, the White House press briefing really has become must-see TV. If you are a news buff, then you watch Sean Spicer's hour, 90-minute presentation every morning, or rather every afternoon, 1 o'clock more or less Eastern time. So first of all, on Sean Spicer, remember how rough it was when he started? He was extremely awkward. His suit didn't fit. He was very insecure in many ways. He seemed he was strident. The relationship between him and the press was very, very, very tough. But he really has loosened up. I'm not saying he's as good as, say, Jay Carney now or Josh Earnest or even Ari Fleischer from the George W. Bush days, but he really is getting much better, Sean Spicer. You got to give him credit. He even told a joke. He told a joke where he said he was going to take his podium and he was going to smash his podium into the crowd of reporters asking him contentious questions. And, of course, he was referring to Melissa McCarthy's terrific takeoff on him on Saturday Night Live.
Does anybody else have any questions?
A Wall Street Journal. Are you okay?
Come on.
Put you in the corner with CNN.
We're not fake news!
So life was imitating art in this sense with Sean Spicer's joke. But the good thing about the joke was that it showed that he is loosening up on the job, that Sean Spicer can be and maybe will be a terrific White House press secretary as he gets more comfortable and he really can, put the president's actions, some of which are very controversial, in some kind of perspective. But I give him kudos. He told the joke, the McCarthy joke. Actually, we have it. I'm gonna play it for the people listening on the podcast. So here is Sean Spicer making fun of himself, summoning the image of Melissa McCarthy on Saturday Night Live.
I think tweeting out, great way to start a Friday. Here are the actual numbers that you all have reported. Is a bit silly. I mean, don't make me make the podium move. I mean, honest to God, like every reporter here reported out that we had 235,000 jobs, 4.7. There isn't a TV station that didn't go live to it. So to tweet out, great way to start a Friday. I think, yes, the president was excited to see more Americans back to work.
All right. That joke, for the benefit of our podcast audience, it was really good. It was really good. Particularly when you contrast it to the one really dramatic and kind of uptight moment of the White House press briefing today. It was all about General Michael Flynn, the national security advisor, who was forced to resign.
At the end of the day, when he found out that General Flynn had betrayed the trust of the vice president back in the day, he let him go. The president has high standards for everyone that works in this administration. So the answer to your question is, if somebody does something that is not in keeping with the president's standards that he set for every single person in the administration, they will be let go.
Yeah, the dream job, I'm sure the job of his life, the former Defense Intelligence Agency head, the president's national security advisor. You know, General Flynn has a way of rubbing people wrong. He was kind of a pariah among many in the intelligence community when he left his old job. But he came to work early for candidate Trump when nobody really gave Donald Trump a chance of winning. But Flynn was right by his side and very strong, very effectively conveying the message that Donald Trump will be strong on defense and that he honors the military and so forth. But the jam that he found himself in, I mean, obviously he resigned because he lied to Vice President Pence about his relationship and what he talked about with the Russians. He said specifically, General Flynn said that he never, for example, discussed sanctions with the Russian contacts he had. And then, the CIA or one of the intelligence agencies came up with the transcript of his various conversations with the Russian ambassador and others in which he did, in fact, talk about sanctions. So General Flynn got caught in a lie. He was forced to resign. Now comes the word that General Flynn was actually a registered foreign agent for Turkey, for the nation of Turkey. You know, when you're a U.S. citizen and you're working on behalf of a foreign government, you've got to register. So when you register, eventually becomes known to people. In this case, he only registered that he was a foreign agent for Turkey a day or two ago. So obviously the news broke today that he was a foreign agent for Turkey. So why do we care if General Flynn was a foreign agent for Turkey? I'll tell you why. Remember, during the whole of the Syrian civil war, during the entire time when all of those refugees were being unleashed or unloosed, this gigantic tsunami of refugees leaving Syria, going into Europe, they were all going through Turkey. Turkey was saying, come on, come this way, you Sunni refugees, come, you could pass through Turkey and we'll give you passage to the western side of Turkey where you can catch a boat, a small boat, for the short passage to Greece. And once you're in Greece, you're in Europe. So Turkey played a key role in helping destabilize Europe. Much more ominously, Turkey allowed itself to be used for recruits for ISIS coming from Europe across those same straits through Turkey into Syria, where they would help kill our allies and our GIs in Syria. So Turkey was not only complicit in allowing the refugees to leave, but also ISIS recruits to come in, and ISIS fighters and killers to go out of Syria through Turkey. So Turkey, until like 10 minutes ago, Turkey was really not working in our best interests in terms of the destabilization of the Middle East, in terms of everything the refugees did to destabilize Europe and everything the ISIS fighters did to bring death and destruction to Europe and everything that ISIS was able to accomplish recruiting these Europeans to come into Syria or Iraq and get training so they could go back home and kill. So Turkey really has had a very problematic status in terms of the U.S. fight against ISIS specifically and against the instability in the Mideast generally. So here's General Flynn. As it turns out, he's a registered foreign agent for Turkey during all this time. You know, I wonder what else the good general had going on. An honorable man, everything I knew about him up until now. Certainly a patriot, everything I knew about him until now. But the fact that he was double dealing with Russia, apparently, or at least to the extent that he felt the need to lie about it when he discussed it with Vice President Pence, and now being revealed as a foreign agent for Turkey, I think that whole thing will and should be. When you think about how lame the whole Benghazi scandal was, the whole email scandalette of Hillary Clinton, and how the Republicans, day after day, committee after committee. Remember when she testified for 11 hours at one point before Trey Gowdy and that committee? I'd like to see Congress pay the same kind of attention to all of these allegations, all of these appearances of conflicts. Now, it could well be, and I'm actually willing to predict, that there is no evidence at all of collusion between the Russians and the Trump campaign to skew the election or hack the election in Donald Trump's favor over Hillary Clinton. I believe I have seen zero evidence of collusion with the Russians. Still, everybody agrees that we have to investigate what happened. If we don't investigate what happened, then shame on us. The Russians will continue to hack our elections. They will continue to attempt to destabilize and undermine confidence in our institutions. They will do as they are doing in Europe right now, try to undermine the whole democratic model by casting doubt on the sanctity and honesty of our elections. I think it's really bad. I don't know, again, if there's any evidence of collusion with the Russians, but there certainly is enough for congressional intelligence committees to see what's there, find out exactly what happened. Now I see CNN is reporting some suspicious activity between a certain Russian bank and people in the Trump campaign. I don't know anything about anything. All I know is let's get an investigation. The investigation can review evidence of collusion. And let's say, as I expect, the Trump campaign is totally cleared of any, I'm going to get out of the slide, any kind of collusion with the Russians. That's great. Then the campaign can also investigate the sensational, the extraordinary allegations by President Trump last Saturday morning that the administration of Barack Obama was wiretapping Donald Trump's Trump Tower offices. They can investigate that. You know, I suspect there will be no collusion with the Russians by Donald Trump. I suspect there will be no wiretapping by Barack Obama's administration of Donald Trump. But there are certainly enough questions that we have to clear the air, and it deserves a full, fair investigation. If they don't investigate this, I mean, you can investigate if you want. You can investigate the leaks from the the intelligence community or whomsoever that's leaking stuff, damaging stuff about Donald Trump. Investigate all that. That's fine. But if Congress doesn't investigate with the same vigor these various allegations, both pro-Trump, anti-Trump, involving Trump in this way or that way, then shame on them. Then all they care about is politics, and that's that really is a pity. I want both houses of the Congress of the United States, both the Senate and the House of Representatives, to have full-throated, deep investigations, because the very sanctity of our election process is at stake. So let's do the right thing in that regard. The president has really stepped into it in terms of Obamacare. Before I get to Obamacare, I just want to say the jobs report today, Friday, March the 10th, 235,000 jobs added. That is great. I'm going to close this blind. Craig, will you just shut this blind here? Thanks. 235 is my brother, Craig. 235,000 jobs added, much better, added in the month of February, which is totally in President Trump's tenure as his first full month in office, 235,000 jobs. I think a couple of things about that. First of all, congratulations to Donald Trump. But second of all, don't forget that Barack Obama presided over the most extraordinary streak of monthly job gains in the history of the United States. From 2009 until and including January of 2017, his last 3 weeks in office, the United States added private sector jobs every single month. The 235,000 that Donald Trump added in February is great and good on him, as I said. But it is also part of that same trend. It is, it started with Barack Obama. It started going up month after month after month. And now February 2017, the first full month of Donald Trump in office, terrific, terrific numbers. My alarm's going off. Terrific jobs numbers. And I congratulate President Trump. I think that is, if you're an investor in the stock market and you're not one of these crazy, try to buy low, sell high, and play the market, if you just or someone who's an S&P Dow Jones investor, from November 8th until today, you're up 7-8%. And a lot of that is because of Donald Trump. There is no doubt but that there is an optimistic feeling now about the economy that is extraordinary. Donald Trump has done a wonderful job in restoring confidence in the economy, even if the confidence was sorely missing unfairly during Barack Obama's term, and only now is they're giving credit to Donald Trump. That's okay. Donald Trump deserves credit because everybody, like I bet everybody listening or watching right now, I bet everybody feels better about the economy than they did 6 months ago. It's all about the economy. The economy, even among Latinos, it's not immigration that's the biggest issue. It's the economy. People want to feel secure in their jobs. They want to feel that they could get a raise next year. They want to feel that their kids coming out of college or high school can get a job in this economy. And I really do believe the confidence that we're feeling now is largely a result of Trump's presidency. Wall Street loves the guy. I think that when these companies are flush, when their stock prices are up, they're going to do more investing. More investing means more hiring. I think just ordinary stockholders feel more comfortable hiring the babysitter, the lawnmower person, the expanding your small business, whatever it is. And I really give Donald Trump credit. I think that's the most important job of a Republican president anyway, any president, but certainly a Republican president, is to give confidence in the economy. I think Donald Trump has done that. He deserves our congratulations, and I give him a slap on the back for that. Good on you, 45th President of the United States. Your travel ban, though, Mr. Trump, I think is, I'll get to Obamacare. I'll end it with that. But the travel ban, I just want to tell you that even though I believe this new travel ban is constitutional, I think that they have so modified the original ban. First of all, now Iraq is not included as one of the nations where the residents are banned now for 3 or 4 months, or in case of Syria, banned forever for coming into the United States. Now that Iraq is off, they've also allowed the new travel ban says that people have a valid visa, they can come in, people have a green card. I spoke about this in the last podcast. But the travel ban, as currently drafted, I believe, is constitutional. Still, and this is the most important thing I'm going to tell you about the travel ban on this podcast, I believe the court will enjoin even the new modified travel ban from being implemented, from being put into effect. Why? It's not because the travel ban itself is unconstitutional. Because if you read it, clearly it is constitutional. And it is also clear that the president has the statutory authority to regulate immigration. That is his purview. There, by statute and by the Constitution of the United States, immigration is a federal responsibility, and the president of the United States can pass a law banning anybody, or as long as it's not an unconstitutional ban. What is an unconstitutional ban? Everybody who's a Muslim is banned, regardless of who they are, where they come from. That's an unconstitutional ban because it's discrimination based on religion. Ironically, one of the things I feel very negative about the new travel ban is that it excludes the exemption that the original travel ban, the flawed travel ban, had for Christians. In the original travel ban, Christians were not banned if they come from any country, or Yazidis, or some of the other religious minorities. Why are they not banned? Because of the logical feeling that who are the most persecuted people in the Mideast right now? The most persecuted people in the Mideast are Christians. That's a fact. The Christian faith is being wiped out in the birthplace of Christ. You go to a place like Bethlehem in the West Bank in Palestine. Bethlehem used to be 80, 90% Christian. Now it's maybe 30% Christian. And that's in the birthplace of Jesus. But more generally, you look at what ISIS did, all of the old shrines, both the prehistoric shrines, the Christian shrines. They are chopping up the legacy of Christians everywhere. Christians are being persecuted. You talk to the Christians of Lebanon, the Christians of Syria, of how ISIS has been targeting them and forcing them to convert and raping the women and so forth and so on. I think that Christians should get some slack when it comes to immigration. I think that it's logical. But they took it out. Why? Because they wanted the travel ban to be constitutional, and they were fearful that if they said Christians can come in some kind of favored status, then the whole thing collapses because it's an unconstitutional discrimination based on religion. That's a catch-22, but it's impractical to eliminate it because Christians, again, are the most imperiled group in the Middle East. And it would seem to me that the president of the United States should hear from some of the evangelical Christian and other groups that are out there to tell him that, say, hey, whatever's going on with this travel ban, you've got to cut some slack to Christians coming from the Middle East because they really are a persecuted minority. So I think that that is unfortunate that that is not in the revised travel ban. So why do I think the revised travel ban will never go into effect? Here's why. It's not what it says on the paper. On the paper, it's fine. It's statutorily justified. It is constitutionally sound. The reason the revised travel ban will never be implemented as written is simply that the court will look behind the paper and say, what is Donald Trump's real intention here? Is his real intention to ban, regardless of religion or sexual orientation or blah, 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 or is his intention to ban Muslims? They will say, we think his intention is to ban Muslims. Why will they say that? Because Donald Trump said that during the campaign. They will use the president's words during the election campaign against him. They will say, hey, Donald Trump, regardless of what the words say in your revised and presumably constitutional travel ban, we know for a fact because you said it, and here's exactly what you said on the date you said it, where you said it, over and over again. You want to implement a ban on all Muslim immigrants. You said it. Therefore, we believe you. Therefore, this travel ban is nothing but a subterfuge for you to avoid the Constitution of the United States and discriminate against those of the Muslim faith who are coming in as refugees. So I don't think the travel ban will ever, ever be implemented because the president, through his own words and his own actions, has polluted the water. Speaking of immigration, two points about immigration from the southern border of the United States. One is that undocumented immigrants, if you prefer the harsh term, illegal immigrants, fine, that immigration across the southern border is down by 40% in the month of February, where historically, because of the growing season, there is usually a spike in undocumented immigrants coming across the southern border from Mexico or Central America. Immigration across the southern border for the month of February, where again, historically, there was a spike in immigration, is down 40%. So it's pretty clear that the president's tough language, or you could say harsh language, about immigrants and deportation and so forth is having an impact. And fewer people are attempting to cross without documentation the southern border. I have no problem with the fact that people are being deterred from trying to cross. I believe there should be a much more liberalized legal immigration system that gives due deference to the historical connection between Mexico and the United States. But I have no problem with the fact that those trying the southern border without proper documentation is down. I think that, you know, it's dangerous. It's a terrible system. We need regulation on the southern border. We need safety. A lot of these people get killed trying to cross. The one thing I will say about the current enforcement is something that General John Kelly, a great man, a great patriot, and the head of the Department of Homeland Security, something he said I found very, very, very offensive. General Kelly said that it is possible going forward that our immigration authorities will separate the children from their parents when they cross the border. In other words, immigration will take the kids and turn back the parents. You know, they say that they can take care of the kids, that they want to keep them safe, they don't want to send them back to cross that rough border line again. I think that's a horrendous, a hideous idea to think that we're going to separate children from their parents under those circumstances, to then put these kids in some kind of foster care or to care for them in some kind of mass facility on the southern border, I think that's really, it's stomach churning. It is so un-American. It's so uncompassionate. I think it really is a dispassionate, whatever the word is. I think it's a terrible, terrible idea. I don't know who thought of it. That's an awful idea. You keep the families together and you sort it out, and then figure out who can stay and who can't. And this whole idea of beefing up the immigration courts by adding more judges to facilitate and expedite that whole process to see who's legit here as a refugee and as an immigrant, I think that I'm all for anything that makes the system more orderly. Because it's way too dangerous, and too many of these folks coming across the southern border are being victimized. Now, if a kid comes across with a coyote, with one of these professional smugglers, you ask the kid, is this your mom and dad? And the kid's, 6-year-old, 7-year-old, a 4-year-old, they're not going to lie. That's my daddy or mi padre or not. You find out who the coyotes, who the professional smugglers are. And if this professional smuggler is with these kids, then you hit them with the additional felony of child trafficking. You hit them again. You're not this child's relative, blood relative. Then you're a child trafficker. Otherwise, why would you be trying to sneak this child across the border into the United States? I think that's different. But if this child is with the child's relatives, you cannot separate the child from the adults. It may be inconvenient to the United States that they've got to deal with these entire families and there's so many to deal with. But my God, can you imagine separating a 6-year-old from the mom and dad, and you turn the mom and dad back? Can you imagine what that visual will be like, that how soul-searing that will be? Which brings me to my final topic today on this 10th edition of the Geraldo podcast on this March the 10th, Friday. I'm doing this at about 3:45 Eastern time. A visual that we cannot abide, that the Republican Party, I'm a Republican, I'm a registered Republican. I usually vote Republican, not always, but usually. But one visual, the Republicans, who now control the House and the Senate and the White House, they control the executive and legislative branches of government. And soon, with the Supreme Court nominee and in time, they'll control the judiciary as well. The one thing the Republican Party will not be able to stand is the visual of Aunt Tilly, who lost her leg to diabetes, who's 62 years old, who can't get Medicare yet, or 61 years old, can't get Medicare yet, and she couldn't get the operation she needed, so Aunt Tilly died because Obamacare has been shelved by the Trump administration. The Republicans cannot withstand the criticism, the tsunami of criticism that will come their way if they defund Obamacare without an appropriate, compassionate replacement for Obamacare. I think that Speaker Ryan and this effort, I know the so-called Freedom Caucus, the 40 or so hardcore, hard right-wing congressmen say they would never vote for it, that it won't even pass the House of Representatives, that there is a sprinkling of Republican senators that won't vote for Ryan Care or Trump Care, whatever you call it, because it's too much of a giveaway. I'm telling you, Obamacare gave an entitlement to people with pre-existing conditions, to other older folks, at the expense of young, healthy people. True, I understand how much that rubs people who believe that everyone should take care of themselves. But I'm telling you, once you take that entitlement away, if you don't replace it with something compassionate, I think you're in trouble. Here's what I think Trump should. With all due respect to the President of the United States, he's dealing with this Obamacare mess. Why didn't he start with the two things that I think everybody agrees on? The two things are, we need lower prescription medication costs, right? Everybody agrees. The drug companies are cleaning our clock. They are emptying our pockets. They're robbing our wallets. They're charging, you get these little EpiPens for allergic reactions and this and that and the other thing. A diabetes shot every day, or a dialysis, or some of these persistent conditions. You take away those entitlements now under Obamacare, and someone gets hurt, someone dies as a result. I'm telling you, the Republicans are going to get voted out of office in the midterm. Those town meetings, those town hall, angry town hall sessions you're seeing now, there's a couple of pros sprinkled here and there. Maybe they're paid for by Judge Soros or whomsoever. I don't know. But the vast majority of those folks are really worried, frightened people who say, someone's going to take away my health care that I've had over the last 6 years. I'm going to be disadvantaged, or I'm going to die, or Aunt Tilly's going to die, or my little youngster's not going to get the care he needs or she needs. It's very difficult to abolish an entitlement. So one thing, why didn't they go after the drug prices? And the second thing they should have done, this is all before they even got to Obamacare. The second thing they should have done, why can't insurance companies sell insurance interstate instead of just intrastate? You know why? Because the insurance company in, say, New Jersey, they don't want competition from outside the state. That's why they lobby the state legislature to pass a law that says only insurance companies registered in New Jersey can sell insurance in New Jersey. The Republicans are saying, wait a second, that benefits the insurance company. It doesn't benefit the people in New Jersey or Pennsylvania or New York or, you know, the whatever the other border states are, or in California or Texas or Washington State or Colorado. Why can't I buy insurance from a Colorado company that's cheaper than the New Jersey or the New York company? Why can't I buy insurance in Florida that's sold by a company in Puerto Rico, or you pick your place? It's strictly a laws, because each state has one, passed because of lobbying by the insurance companies to protect the monopolies. The Republicans should have started with lower prescription drug pricing and interstate insurance sales, and they would have had a lot less pushback. But now they've taken on Obamacare. And I tell you, because I'm for socialized medicine. I think everybody should have Medicare or Medicaid. I think that that's the single payer. It's the easiest, best way. You know, I sang on Fox and Friends this morning the old line from the Peter, Paul, and Mary song. If religion was a thing that money could buy, the rich would live, the poor would die. I don't want the rich living and the poor dying. I want everybody to get all the medical care they need. And I think that will ultimately, like the VA, people put down the VA. I remember the VA before this whole scandal about waiting time. The actual, once you got in to see a VA doctor, most of the GIs that I spoke to, they liked the care. You know, once they got into it, I think that, and look at the Congress, the great health care they get. I just would like Americans to all have that kind of care. But so now, Paul Ryan, who's a terrific guy, Speaker Ryan, has come up with this plan. This plan is, it's not as generous to the beneficiaries as Obamacare, but it's not as strict in cutting them off as the so-called Freedom Caucus wants. Freedom Caucus wants the federal government out of U.S. health care. The Democrats want a single payer, and Paul Ryan and this President Trump approach is somewhere in the middle, which is fine as a compromise, as compromises go. But I come back to what I said about anybody that gets harmed by the new law, cutting them off. Anyone who gets harmed, that person is going to be an effective anti-Republican campaigner come the 2018 midterm elections. This whole healthcare, Obamacare debate is fraught with peril for the Republican majority. You have to go slow with this. It's hard to take away entitlements. You should have started, and it's not too late to go right now and say, you know something, we're going to table this new Ryan Care, Trump Care. We're going to put that aside for now. We're going to go after the drug companies, get them to agree to lower drug prices. President Trump's a terrific negotiator. He's the guy that could do it. Sit down with Pfizer and all these other companies and say, you know, this drug costs you 2 cents to produce. Why are you charging $200? I think it's a good place to start. Prescription drug, drug companies have, you know, got to get more competition and have to get lower prices and interstate. Just start over with those things that everybody can agree on. All things considered, and I come back where I started, because the economy is humming along, because unemployment's down to 4.7%, because we added 235,000 jobs in the month of February, because all the indicators are green and up for the economy, I think President Trump gets the credit for that. He's the man who's conjured up this rising tide. It is lifting all boats, and a thriving, humming economy take care of a lot of these issues. We'll take care of a lot of these questions. So let's give in his first 50 days, I give the president a D or C minus when it comes to messaging. I think he's been awful. These tweets are awful. I love tweets, generally speaking. I mean, I use Twitter a lot myself. You can't tweet an allegation that your predecessor in office wiretapped your Trump Tower unless you got real proof and you're willing to share that proof with the American people. I think that, Trump's got to ease up with these tweets. It's one thing to say, yay, I celebrate 235,000 jobs added. It's another thing to say, President Obama, you're bad, you're sick, and you wiretap my office. That's so intemperate, so immature, that's all people think about. Until now, until the economy, I'm telling you, that's the story they should tell over and over and over again. I told you that Wall Street would love me. You're making money because I'm the president of the United States. Everybody that wants a job is going to get a job in this country. And, that rising tide will lift all boats. Thank you very much. Have a great weekend. I appreciate your watching or listening. I'll see you next time.